books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we'll have a chat to Neil Lancaster about the latest D.S. Max Craigie book, The Devil You Know. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. All coming up on today's Read On. Neil Lancaster is the best-selling author of both the Tom Novak and the Max Craigie series. Before he became an author, he was a military policeman in the RAF, serving in the UK, Germany, Cyprus and on the Falkland Islands. In 1990, he joined the Metropolitan Police, where he ended up working as a detective, investigating the most serious of crimes in the capital and beyond. He was a covert policing specialist, using all sorts of tactics to obtain evidence against murderers, human traffickers, drug dealers and fraudsters. Since leaving the Met in 2015, he relocated to the Scottish Highlands and poured all that experience into his crime and thriller novels. The fifth Max Craigie book came out yesterday and is read, like all the others in the series, by Angus King.
Leo Hamilton stared across the table at his client, Davy Hardy, in the legal visits room at Shotts Prison. The high-ceilinged room was echoey and depressing, with scuffed walls and peeling cream paint, flecks of which were scattered on the dusty linoleum floor. Davy picked at a fissure in the scratch Formica tabletop, as Leo felt some degree of shock at what he'd just heard from his client. He'd acted for the Hardy family for many years, thought he knew all the dark secrets. But he didn't know this one.
"Are you sure about this, Davy?"
Leo asked, feeling a flutter of nerves in his belly. What Davy had imparted was something that he'd never expected to hear in his 20-year association with the Hardy family. In the past, instructions had always come from Tam Hardy Sr., then, after his death, Tam Jr. He'd had very little to do with either Davy or his older brother Frankie. But as Tam Jr. had disappeared without trace after being sprung from Sockton a couple of years ago, he guessed that he now took his instructions from whoever delivered them. His firm still had a sizeable amount of money on account from the Hardy Legal Trust, so he was duty-bound to act on his client's behalf.
"Of course I'm sure. I'm only a couple of years into a 12 stretch."
Davy's face was hard and grim, and Leo could sense the bitterness.
"Not gonna lie, Davy. You are lucky to only get 12. I'm not a bragging man, but keeping you out of the murders your big brother was convicted of was a work of legal genius."
Angus King reading from The Devil You Know by Neil Lancaster. When Neil joined me from his home in the Highlands, I first asked him about the start of his career in the RAF.
Yeah, I joined the RAF in 1983. I grew up in a fairly standard working class house for the secondary modern school in Sevenoaks in Kent. And I joined the RAF in 1983, basically because I didn't really know what else to do. I stayed for 6 years and had a really good time.
Now, we've got a few members of staff off training with guide dogs, and I believe dogs were quite big at the start of your career.
Very much so. Yes, I was an RAS police dog handler. I did that for sort of 5 or 6 years. I had about three different dogs, and I served overseas in Germany, and I spent some time in the Falkland Islands as well, dog handler. So yeah, they're a very, very big part of my life.
And how did you make the move from the RAF to the Met?
My grandfather had been a police officer in Liverpool, a very notable police officer. And it sort of struck a big chord with me, and it was probably some good salesmanship from my dad. But I really always wanted to be a police officer. The RAF was kind of an interlude, or should I say really a prelude, in that I didn't want to be a cop starting at sort of 18 and a half. I wanted to do something else. So I decided to join the RAF because I thought it'd be a chance to, you know, travel a bit overseas, see a bit different life. And that's exactly what it did. And it was the perfect start for me. And when I joined the Met Police, I was actually 24. So I was in what I thought was a really good place to start in that journey, because it is a very different way being a policeman walking around London than a military policeman. I mean, couldn't be more big.
Now, you were a detective, but in those days, it would have been, you had to work your way up. Did you start off in uniform?
Yeah, back in those days, everybody started off uniform. And in the vast majority of cases, they still do. You do have direct entry detectives, but most people still start off wearing their cloth, as we always say. Yeah, I joined up as a PC on the beat, and I was working in Northwest London, which was a very challenging environment. It was quite deprived, incredibly diverse, and it was a tough place to police, but it was a great place to start because you got exposed to everything, quite literally everything.
How does your career reflect on Max Craigie?
Well, in a number of ways, really. I mean, I put a bit of myself in Max in terms that, you know, he's an ex-soldier himself. He's ex-Metropolitan Police. He's also a specialist in covert police and surveillance, which was very much what I got involved with after a few years, you know, on the beat, going into detective work. I then moved to the Homicide Command, and I was working on a covert unit within that, where we would put together sort of complex operations and covert operations. And probably the most notable case I worked on was the case of Levi Belford, who's a serial killer, who killed three women in the sort of early 2000s. And I was part of the surveillance of him, which was very, very challenging.
So we've gone from being in the RAF to being in the police. How did you make the jump from being a detective to being an author?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a long time coming because, I mean, I went from working on the Homicide Command, running around, flying around all over the country, chasing really bad. And then I moved on and I got promoted and spent a lot of time on another serious and complex fraud investigation team. And then, so, you know, time zoomed by, as it obviously does. And because of my RAF time, it meant I could leave, I could take my pension at 49. And so that's what I decided to do. And we've been living in the home counties in sort of Auburns for a number of years. But we've fallen in love with the Highlands from visiting regularly for family. And so one day we just made a decision that we should give it a go. And we literally up sticks and we moved 600 miles north to where I live now on the Black Isle, which is a sort of a fairly small peninsula just outside Inverness. Now, obviously, I then found myself going from living this frantic, busy life, long commute, I'd learned they try to catch the worst of the criminals and everything like that, to finding myself with not very much to do. Work for somebody with my kind of skill set was a bit limited. But you know what? I did some private investigation work. But then I found myself really with what I needed. I'd always been a hugely keen reader, and I'd always read. And I literally just one day thought, I wonder if I could write a book. No more thought given written that, but I wonder if I can write a book. So I opened up my laptop and I just started. Quite literally, no more thought given written than that. I wonder if I can do it. And I just started writing this story. And I of the first of my Novak trilogy, the first thing I wrote was a book with a character called Detective Sergeant Tom Novak. I wrote that book and it went pretty well. And I managed to get a deal with a small publisher. And that book sold okay. It gave me enough confidence to keep trying and trying to get better. So I wrote another couple of books in that series, which all sold fairly well. But then we was quite funny. If you let me tell this story, which really gives way back to Craig and Campbell. In 2019, we spent Christmas with some friends in Pitlochry. And we're in this great big sort of country manor with a load of other people who come all over the place. We get together for Christmas. One of these guys was an elderly Scottish man who had spent 50 years in Australia. He'd come back on a visit. And he was a big fan of crime fiction. Told me this story and said, I was looking into my wife's background, her family background, and I found myself in this old ancient graveyard in Caithness.
in the wilds of Caithness. Now, right in the middle of this bird, he says, there was a graveyard with no chapel. And I went in there and scraped all the undergrowth off one of the graves. And the grave just said, this grave never to be opened. And I just thought, oh my goodness, when he told me it, it was like, I don't know, it was like fireworks going up in my head. Because I thought, I've got to make this into a book. I've got to find a way of drawing this book. So I came up with the idea. I knew I didn't want to write a historical book, which that kind of thing I think may well lend itself towards. I didn't want to write anything about pandemics because obviously we're just coming into it. So I came up with the idea of 3S Metrograde and about what would happen if assumed from the 1830s came back to life in modern day. And I wrote it as a contemporary crime thriller. And that's how the series was born. And I got myself an agent on the basis of it. And then I got myself a 3-book deal with HarperCollins. And that's led me to be where I am now. So it was literally came out of that one conversation in a house in the Highlands.
Tam Hardy was now sure he had found the place. He felt a swell of emotion in his chest as he surveyed the dense tangle of bracken, gorse and brambles that covered the low wall of the cemetery. The only evidence of a chapel was a few scattered heaps of granite blocks surrounding the grassy broch. The landscape was sweeping, panoramic and bleak. The sea was not quite visible, but it was definitely there, being the source of the incoming haar, which crept closer by the second. As it swirled, he could just make out the wind farms in the surrounding fields that lay motionless in the still air. He had read some mentions of the disused burial ground on the web, but it had taken a lot of driving around the barren landscape, as well as asking the locals in the inn in Dunbeath before he had managed to find it. He picked out the creased black-and-white photograph from his barber jacket pocket and looked again at the old image that he had studied many times over the years. As a younger man, he had given it scant attention, but age and the reality of one's mortality have a way of making you more nostalgic for the past. Tam felt a rush of excitement. The undergrowth was thicker and taller, and the wall was a little shorter, more dilapidated. But Tam was certain. This was the burial ground his grandfather had once told him about. He walked quickly, wheezing heavily in the late afternoon chill, as the cold mist began to creep across the landscape from the North Sea. He shivered as the damp, clammy air bit at his exposed skin. His chest burned, and he coughed, deep, racking hacks that made his head swim. Wiping his mouth with his handkerchief, he tried to ignore the spots of blood on the white fabric. Something made him shudder, and it wasn't just the haar dropping the air temperature, as it always did. He looked over his shoulder, back towards his Range Rover. Is that a noise? He wondered. He stood there for a long moment, staring into the distance, but nothing moved. He shivered, surprised at the slight nip of nerves that began to form in his stomach. Shaking his head, he moved on, determined to face whatever lay in that graveyard.
That's Angus King reading from the first T.S. Max Craigie book, Dead Man's Grave. Now, we're on to book five. It came out yesterday. Tell us about The Devil You Know.
Well, The Devil You Know, it came about. I spent a fair bit of time during my time in the Met dealing with human trafficking cases. And I was always struck by the victims in these cases, because the victims can be quite tricky to deal with. Many of them don't view themselves as victims, certainly not initially, because they've been groomed into it. So I wanted to tell that story about a trafficking victim who had found the good lives here. She'd been rescued by the police from her traffickers. She'd been successfully fostered in a place in the Highlands. And my wife is there.
hospital in adoption social work. So there were some stories I wanted to tell there. But there was something else. There was what struck me was, because it starts off with her going missing. Because what happens is she was trafficked to the UK from Albania. This girl called Ivan Zakadu. They wanted to get her into prostitution, but in the short term, she was running drugs for this Albanian criminal network. But she's rescued by the pigs. But then I thought, well, what happens if a couple of years later, she's now living successfully. She's a promising athlete. She's a beach student. She's got a great life. So the story is that her identity is supposed to be protected and location is supposed to be protected. But corrupt cops, someone corrupt within the police in Scotland, has leaked their details. And then she's kidnapped again. So it's a race against time thriller about getting her back and then uncovering who the corrupt forces are within the Scotland. And I'm delighted with it. I think it's the best book I've written so far.
The audio version of The Devil You Know is read by Angus King, as are all the Max Cree books. Do you have any choice in the narrator?
My editor persuaded me that Angus was the man. And I listened to a number of his audio books that are done by, by people done for people I know. And it struck me that this guy really is great. And he really is absolutely fantastic. He really brings the characters to life. He's given her his own spin. We have a conversation. I have a conversation with him. So every time he's actually recording one, he'll always phone me up and say, hang on, what about this? And how do you feel this accent would be? Because I didn't teach him to throw a few accents into the mix. So I've been absolutely delighted with him. I'm a huge fan of Ordinary. So I listen to them all the time. So it's a real thrill for me to be in audio. And great, I know lots of people listening to Max Cree. And much of that is by to answer his skin as a narrator.
It's important your books are available in things like audio so that they can be enjoyed by someone for whatever reason can access print.
Absolutely. It's audio is now, of course, it's for everyone. I mean, of course, it's an absolute bonus for people who are visual. But we all know now that audio is one of the fastest growing formats because everybody loves this. It's a very different experience than just sitting there and reading the book, which I love to do. But, this allows me to be busy doing other stuff. I can be on a car journey. I can be mowing the lawn and still listening to stories. And I think it's such a bonus. And I love the fact that we visually impaired people now have access to more or less reading the books. It's just brilliant.
Drippy. Aye. Drippy because he looks like that cartoon dog with a sad face. Once I'm out of here and my parole date is sorted, I'll give them the lot. My pa always kept proof when he did favours for his acorns, and I know exactly where it is. What type of proof? Davies scratched at his forearm before continuing. The best kind. It's on film. Pa always wanted proof when he subbed a job out, so it was filmed by Droopy and sent to Jack. Jack then gave it to Pa, who downloaded it onto an SD card. How's that tie it to the main man? A long, slow smile stretched across Davy's face. Pa was a careful man, and he knew everyone in Glasgow mattered. He knew exactly which hotel and even which bloody room that the man took Beata to for their liaisons. Davy mimed quotation marks with his fingers and took a sip of water from the plastic cup on the table. Tom Hardy was a smart man, Davy. Leo nodded, approvingly, but a huge part of him wasn't sorry that Tom Hardy Sr. was no longer with them. Leo had his own skeletons, and it was likely that Tom knew all about them.
The Devil You Know by Neil Lancaster is available in print as an ebook and in audio as read by Angus King. And Neil, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Apologies about the quality of that call in places, but Neil will be back at the end of today's show for the books of his life. And talking of books...
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. First this week, For those who like their crime historical and also cosy, we have Miss Austin Investigates by Jessica Bull, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
By moonlight, Jane hitches up the hem of her muslin gown and darts across the neatly scythed lawn. The fireworks are over, but the musky tang of gunpowder lingers in her throat, and the din of a raucous crowd rises above the efforts of the string quartet performing in the Tudor mansion behind her. It is 9 o'clock, and the ball has hardly begun. Jane, accompanied by two of her elder brothers, James and Henry, arrived less than an hour ago. But already the finest society in all of Hampshire are tipsy and braying at each other over the melody. As she crosses the manicured garden, Jane crouches behind each colossal tower of yew to check for onlookers. Her heart pounds at the ruinous prospect of being spotted. God forbid she is caught sneaking away from the party unchaperoned. Her feet are cold, and damp is seeping through her shell-pink silk slippers. They were made for pirouetting on polished mahogany, not dashing across frosty grass.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that every good mystery is in need of a brilliant sleuth. Welcome to Hampshire, 1795, where a young Jane Austen has her sights set on securing a marriage proposal from the dashing Tom Lefroy at a local ball. But when a shocking discovery is made, a milliner's lifeless body tucked away in a linen closet, Jane finds herself embroiled in an unexpected murder mystery. As she races against the clock to clear her beloved brother Georgie's name, Jane uses her sharp wits to navigate the treacherous waters of society, unmasking secrets and unearthing hidden motives along the way. With every twist and turn, Jane's determination to solve the case deepens, and if she fails, her brother will face the ultimate punishment, the hangman's noose. Join Jane on her quest for justice as she faces down danger, deceit and scandal amidst her own friends and neighbours. Will she uncover the truth in time, or will the real killer go free? One thing's for certain, in Hampshire, nothing is as it seems.
Her breath turns to steam. The bare branches of a laburnum reach out like the bony arms of a great skeleton, but she races on regardless. Tonight, she and her clever young man will come to their agreement. He will make her an offer of marriage. She is sure of it. Which words will Tom select for his purpose? My dearest Jane, you must allow me to tell you. Miss Austen, I offer myself to you. She will listen carefully and commit each phrase to memory. It could prove useful the next time one of her heroines receives a proposal. Flickering lamps guide her path to the glass house. She presses down gently on the door handle, yet it creaks and the hinges groan as she slips inside. Exotic orchids perfume the misty atmosphere, and she touches a hand to the back of her head. Her maid coiled her chestnut hair into a passably elegant chignon, with ringlets framing her face. If her curls turn to frizz, her brothers will guess where she's been and report her to their mother. A lean figure steps out from behind a desert pine. He is fair with distinguished features, and instantly recognizable in his ivory swallowtail coat. Mademoiselle? The deep timbre of his voice dissolves Jane's heart and propels her towards him. Pausing just out of his reach, she gazes upwards through fluttering eyelashes. It was most wicked of you to lure me here alone. His bright blue eyes sparkle and his mouth curls into a seductive smile. You understood my message then? I understood you perfectly, Monsieur Lefroy. Jane's gaze locks on his lips and she lets herself be gathered tight into his arms. His mouth hovers over hers, and she tips her head back to accept his kiss. She is almost, but not quite, as tall as he. Their relative statures seem designed to aid their amour. Glued together, they stumble into a row of shelves. Beside Jane, a terracotta pot tumbles and smashes at her feet. Dark earth spills across the clay floor tiles. She breaks free, stooping to pick up the tangle of roots and placing the plant carefully back inside its damaged pot. Tom bends down on one knee, cupping her face in his palm. Is this the moment he'll propose? He directs her eyes back to his. Leave the wretched weed, Jane. It doesn't matter. But I must. We are guests. It's only respectful. Jane's heartbeat returns to a regular rhythm as she places the orchid back on the shelf beside its neighbours. She fingers the tall stem, lined with papery chartreuse flowers, until the plant looks as if it was never disturbed. Tom kicks shards of terracotta beneath the cabinet with the toe of his dancing pump. Besides, someone will know we've been in here. He silences her protests with kisses. Slowly, he peels one kid leather glove down her arm and pulls it free. Jane presses her naked palm to his, their fingers interlacing. Through half-closed eyes, she watches the condensation form rivulets and slide down the walls of the glasshouse, and waits for the strings to strike up again. A drop of moisture falls to the floor. Wait. Something is wrong. I can't hear the music.
Miss Austin Investigates by Jessica Bull is narrated by Mia McKenna-Bruce and runs for 10 hours, 25 minutes.
Donated by HarperCollins is the decades-spanning mystery The Garden of Lost Secrets by Kerry Barrett.
The house had a drive. Not a patch of paving stones in front of the house that a normal-sized car didn't quite fit on, like our house in London had. This drive was more like a private road, with gravel that crunched beneath the wheels of our car and made Marco tut because he didn't like anything that could damage the paintwork. The entrance to the house was marked by two pillars built from the same honey-coloured stone as all the buildings nearby, and a strange, small, square, brick-built sentry post. In the summer, we can hold events in the garden and sell ice cream from that funny wee building, Marco said, slowing down to stop the gravel flying up. It'll be perfect. I looked out of the window at the tangled mess of undergrowth, fallen trees and muddy paths, and tried to look enthusiastic. Definitely, I said. Marco pulled up outside the house next to a dirty black SUV, and we got out of the car, stretching after the long drive. Here we are then, he said. He put his arm around me. A new start.
1943. With her best friend having recently joined the Land Army and her mother lost in grief after the death of her father early in the war, Gloria is lonely. When she finds an unlikely kindred spirit in Jerome, an American soldier stationed in her Cotswolds village, Gloria begins to fall in love. But the conflict between the soldiers and the villagers lead to an impossible choice with devastating consequences. Present day. After their dreams of starting a family are crushed, Philippa and her husband Marco need a fresh start. Focusing on repairing the crumbling walls and leaking roof of the Cotswolds house they impulsively bought seems easier work than repairing their relationship. When Philippa finds a hidden memorial hidden deep in the garden, the discovery only pushes them further apart. But as Philippa determines to uncover the truth behind their memorial, could the secrets it reveals be the key to finally putting their heartbreak to rest?
An exciting new start, I agreed, firmly, almost as though I was trying to persuade myself. Mr. and Mrs. Costello? A man in a three-piece suit got out of the SUV, grinning broadly but unconvincingly. That's us, I said. Philippa and Marco. Graham Hodgson. He reached out and shook my hand. Hodgson and Dobbs estate agents. He turned to Marco and shook his hand too. Ciao, he said. Welcome to Honeyford House. Benvenuto. Marco pushed his dark, curly hair off his forehead and smiled at him. Hiya, he said in his broadest West of Scotland accent. Good to meet you, Graham. Graham looked startled for a moment and then recovered his composure. Did you come far? South London, I said. The removal van should be here any minute. I have some keys for you. Graham dropped them into my hand. Let me show you around. We've been here lots of times, I started to say, but Graham was already walking up the steps to the big front door. Looks like we're getting a tour, I said to Marco, wandering over to where he was standing on the gravelly drive that surrounded the house, looking out over the garden. He turned to me and put his arm round my shoulders, pulling me close and kissing my temple. This was a good decision, he mumbled into my hair. It's just what we need, something new to focus on, the beginning of the rest of our lives. I leaned into him for a second, enjoying the closeness after all the time we'd spent far apart. Then I took his hand Come on, Graham wants to show us round.
The Garden of Lost Secrets by Kerry Barrett is narrated by Catherine Walker Booth and Mary Woodvine and runs for 9 hours 10 minutes. We'll have two more brand new books in a moment, but let's hear from one of my favourite narrators.
Hello, I'm Garrick Hagen, and I've been reading for R&IB Talking Books, although I don't like to remind myself, for about 20 years. I think my first book was Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, and I remember that was a bit of a lesson for me, as I had to learn to sit still and be very careful about my enunciation. One of my favorite books over all those years, because we laugh so much, was Radio Romance by Garrison Keillor. It reminded me of my old radio days, although maybe they weren't as funny as Garrison Keillor's radio days. Back in Toronto, when I was a child, I had a program, and it was on Saturday mornings, but also then I did drama with young children on Saturday mornings with fairy stories. It was called Doorway to Fairyland. So it reminded me of all that, the good old times in CBC Radio in Toronto, but also because Garrison Keillor is very funny. It was a joy to read. Studio B was the snakebite studio at WLT, the tomb of the radio mummy, and bad things happened to people who went in there. It was a big triangular room on the second floor of the Hotel Ogden, where WLT was located, at 12th and LaSalle in downtown Minneapolis. Dad Benson said it felt like a vacuum chamber. Once, he gasped for breath during Friendly Neighbor, and two huge flies dove into his throat and almost choked him. The Reverend Irving James Knox claimed he couldn't hear himself talk in there when he did Hope for Tomorrow. He was used to sanctuaries where his words rolled off the walls like ocean surf. In Studio B, the waves hit a big sponge. Reed Seymour once got the hiccups so bad in there his partial plate came off and he had to gum the news. And a week later, three of the Shepherd Boys, a gospel quartet, slipped in and quietly de-pantsed him during a long account of a tragic house fire, leaving 6 persons dead in St. Paul. He kept reading, but he yipped twice when they pulled off his shorts. Every other day or so, the shepherds snuck in during the noontime news to play their little tricks. They put spit in his water glass and pelted him with food and poured mucilage in his shoes, and one day they lit the script on fire and he had to read very fast. It was an obituary, and he never got to the survived by part. So the next day, Reed locked the studio door. Then, after the newscast was safely delivered, the door wouldn't unlock. That was the sort of thing that happened in Studio B. I love reading here because, first of all, it's a very friendly atmosphere, and the studios are good, and the books are generally worthy. Now I hope to continue reading for another 20 years. I hope you, as well as I, enjoy the talking books that are done here at the R&IB, and thanks for listening to them.
Talking Books on R&IB Connect Radio.
This is an R&IB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the R&IB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy a book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
Another thriller donated by Penguin Random House is The Woman on the Ledge by Ruth Mancini.
I wake with a start, my heart racing. There's a second or two of confusion as the morning light creeps through the slats in my blind. Then I hear it. Banging. Male voices shouting. Open up! Police! For a second or two, I'm so heavy with sleep and fear that I can't move a muscle. My stomach tugs and my mind whirls. They've come for me. They've finally come for me. Then it starts up again, the banging. It's loud. They're at the front door, I realise with alarm. Someone's buzzed them in through the communal door. They can't have rung my buzzer, I'd have heard it. In a flat this small, it sounds as though they're already in my front room. George, my cat, springs off the bed and darts underneath the wicker chair. I push my covers back quickly. Coming! I shout, but my voice comes out high-pitched and thin. I hope they can hear me. I don't want them to start breaking down the door.
Kate Kinsella is a single out-of-work actor working as a temp at a London bank when the police arrest her for murder. A woman has fallen to her death from the bank's 25th floor roof terrace. Tate confesses to having been alone with the victim moments before she died, but insists she had nothing to do with the tragedy, telling her lawyer she's been framed. The lawyer agrees to help Tate prove her innocence, but it soon becomes clear Tate knows a lot more than she's letting on. Whose secrets is Tate keeping and why? As the mystery unfolds, it becomes clear that the key to the truth lies in the past and that nothing about the woman on the ledge is as straightforward as it first appears. Murder, obsession, revenge. The Woman on the Ledge is a psychological thriller and a powerful story of female friendship that won't let you go until the final gripping page.
I reach for my jeans and pull them on as quickly as I can, then grab a clean T-shirt from a pile of laundry that's sitting on top of the chair. I grapple with my nightdress, yanking it off, and pull the T-shirt over my head, catching my arm painfully on the bedroom door handle as I run down the hall. I'm coming! I call again, gripping my sore arm. I reach up and grab the key from the ledge above the front door. My fingers are trembling as I slide back the security chain. Just a second, I plead. I just need to unlock it. I turn the key and push up the latch. They swarm in. Huge men in uniform and stab vests in my tiny hallway. Two, then three, then four of them. They push their way in, invade my space, as if I'm the dangerous criminal they think I am. A female cop is here now, thank God. Tate Kinsella. Yes. She takes my forearm and lifts my hand, snaps a handcuff over my wrist. Tate Kinsella, I'm arresting you on suspicion of murder, she says, and then rattles off quickly, off pat. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence. Got that? I nod. They search my living room and bedroom. Then, while I stand in the kitchen with the female cop, the handcuffs clamped heavy and tight around my wrists. I run my tongue over my teeth and glance around the kitchen, my mind spinning with all the things I need to think of. But being shackled so close to a complete stranger, I can't get my thoughts straight. The roof of my mouth is bone dry. Can I get a drink of water? I ask, nodding towards the sink. The counter next to it is piled up with plates and dirty dishes. Last night's empty wine glasses, two of them. Smears of ketchup and grains of egg-fried rice on the worktop. Wine and a takeaway. The kind of meal you eat when you've got something to celebrate. The cop's eyes follow mine. I wonder if she's already profiling me. Not now, later, she says. My cat, I say. I need to make arrangements. What arrangements? My neighbour, please, I need to call her. My phone, it's by the bed,
We'll sort that out for you. She lives two floors up. She has a key. I just need to ask her to feed the cat. Like I said, we'll sort that out.
The Woman on the Ledge by Ruth Mancini is read by Annabelle Scully and runs for 9 hours 56 minutes.
Recently, Simon & Schuster have given us the thriller Zero Days by Ruth Weir.
The wall around the perimeter was child's play. 6 foot, but no spikes or barbed wire on the top. Barbed wire is my nemesis. There's a reason they use it in war zones. At 5'2", I couldn't quite reach to pull myself up, so I scaled a nearby tree with a sturdy branch overhanging the car park, lowered myself until my feet made contact with the top of the wall, and then ran softly along it to a place where I could drop down out of sight of the CCTV cameras that circled the building at intervals. On the other side of the car park was the fire door Gabe had described, and it looked promising. A standard half-glazed door with a horizontal release bar on the inside. I saw with satisfaction that it was poorly fitted, with a gap at the bottom that you could practically get your hand through. It was the work of about 30 seconds to slip my long metal slider underneath, swing it up so the hook caught on the bar, and pull firmly down. The door opened, and I held my breath, waiting for the alarm. Fire doors are always risky like that. But none came.
Hired by companies to break into buildings and hack security systems, Jack and her husband Gabe are the best penetration specialists in the business. But after a routine assignment goes horribly wrong, Jack arrives home to find her husband dead. To add to her horror, the police are closing in on their only suspect, her. On the run and out of options, Jack must decide who she can trust as she circles closer to the truth.
Inside, the lights flicked on automatically. Big fluorescent squares in a tiled ceiling that stretched away into the darkness like a chessboard. The far end of the corridor was still pitch black. The sensors there not yet picking up my movement. But the section I was in was bright as day, and I stood letting my eyes adjust to the glare. Lights are a bit of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, they're a huge red flag to anyone monitoring the security cameras. There's nothing like a screen lighting up like Christmas to catch a security guard's eye and make them glance up from their phone. But you can sometimes style it out if you're caught walking confidently around a building at night when the lights are on. It's much harder to explain your presence if you're creeping along an unlit corridor with a torch. You might as well be wearing a striped T-shirt and carrying a bag marked loot. Right now, it was 10:20 p.m. and I was wearing my office clothes. Black trousers that looked like they could be the bottom half of a suit, but were actually stretchier and more breathable than any regular office wear. A dark blue blouse and a black blazer that was standard off the peg from Gap. On my feet were black Converse, and I had a grey Fjällräven backpack slung over my shoulder. Only my hair was out of place. This month it was dyed a fluorescent scarlet, that wasn't close to any natural shade and didn't really fit in with the slightly stuffy atmosphere of this company, an insurance group called Arden Alliance. Gabe had suggested a wig, but wigs were always a risk, and besides, I was getting into character.
Zero Days by Ruth Weir is read by Imogen Church and runs for 13 hours, 57 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now a return to Neil Lancaster for the books of his life. Neil, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
There definitely was. And I can remember almost like it was yesterday. My sisters are both older than me. One's 4 years old and the other one's 8. Well, I remember when my sister was doing her A-level, I read this literature book, My Family and Other Animals by Gerald Dole. My mum said to me, she read it after my sister had read it for her A-level, and said, "You've got to read this book. You'll absolutely love it." And I hadn't really read much of it. I'd have been maybe 11. And so she threw it over to me. I'd probably been reading it either. But so I read this book and I just loved it. I just, it sort of flicked a switch for me. It was like one of these damascene moments where you kind of realize what a book can do, what words on a page can do, how they can make you feel. And it really catapulted back to caution in the 1930s. Obviously, the basic story is a very wealthy-ish family all up sticks and moved to Corfu in the 1930s. And Gerald Dowell, Britain was about 10 at the time, was obsessed by wildlife. And it's the story of him going out and looking at the wild iceberg. And it was just this incredible collection of experiences and talking about people of Corfu. And today I can feel like a warm glow in myself just talking about it. Magnificent.
July had been blown out like a candle by a biting wind that ushered in a leaden August sky. A sharp, stinging drizzle fell, billowing into opaque grey sheets when the wind caught it. Along the Bournemouth seafront, the beach huts turned blank wooden faces towards a greeny-grey, froth-chained sea that leapt eagerly at the cement bulwark of the shore. The gulls had been tumbled inland over the town, and they now drifted above the housetops on taut wings, whining peevishly. It was the sort of weather calculated to try anyone's endurance. Considered as a group, my family was not a very prepossessing sight that afternoon, for the weather had brought with it the usual selection of ills to which we were prone. For me, lying on the floor, labelling my collection of shells, it had brought catarrh, pouring it into my skull like cement, so that I was forced to breathe stertorously through open mouth. For my brother Leslie, hunched dark and glowering by the fire, it had inflamed the convolutions of his ears so that they bled delicately but persistently. To my sister Margot, it had delivered a fresh dappling of acne spots to a face that was already blotched like a red veil. For my mother, there was a rich, bubbling cold and a twinge of rheumatism to season it. Only my eldest brother Larry was untouched, but it was sufficient that he was irritated by our failings. It was Larry, of course, who started it. The rest of us felt too apathetic to think of anything except our own ills, but Larry was designed by Providence to go through life like a small blonde firework, exploding ideas in other people's minds, and then curling up with cat-like unctuousness and refusing to take any blame for the consequences. He had become increasingly irritable as the afternoon wore on. At length, glancing moodily round the room, he decided to attack Mother as being the obvious cause of the trouble. "Why do we stand this bloody climate?" he asked suddenly, making a gesture towards the rain-distorted window. "Look at it. And if it comes to that, look at us. Margot swollen up like a plate of scarlet porridge, Leslie wandering round with 14 fathoms of cotton wool in each ear. Jerry sounds as though he'd had a cleft palate from birth. And look at you. You're looking more decrepit and haggard every day."
My Family and Other Animals by Gerald Durrell is available from RNIB Talking Books as narrated by Nigel Davenport. Now, is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Well, I'd have been about probably 12. I picked it up, and it was a book called Running Blind by Desmond Bagley. Desmond Bagley was kind of the poor relation to Alistair McCann when it came to the action-adventure thriller writers of the 1970s. I think that's totally unfair. I think it's as good as any. Running Blind is a story of a lax security service agent living a reclusive life in Scotland. He's approached and basically forced to go and do what is sold to him as a very simple delivery package to a contact in Iceland. He goes off to do this job, and obviously everything all goes wrong. And he ends up at the center of a great big conspiracy in Iceland that it's so exciting. It's very much reminiscent of the insulting type espionage, double agents, triple agents. And it is fascinating. It's so fascinating. But it's, I think, the book I attribute to giving me more than any other book towards being a writer. Well, I'd forgotten about when I became a writer. Somebody asked me about it, and I remembered it. And I went back and read it, and I was astounded as to how much of that book influenced how I write today in terms of how it feels, about building tension, about twists. And it sticks with me today that it's a book I can still go back and read, transports me back in time, but also it still stands today as a really great thriller. I encourage any reader.
Less than 2 hours previously, the airliner had slid beneath the clouds, and I saw the familiar, grim landscape of southern Iceland. The aircraft lost height over the Reykjanes Peninsula and landed dead on time at Keflavik International Airport, where it was raining a thin drizzle, weeping from an iron-grey sky. I was unarmed, if you accept the Skian Dhu. Customs officers don't like guns, so I didn't carry a pistol, and Slade said it wasn't necessary. The Skian Dhu, the black knife of the Highlander, is a much underrated weapon, if, these days, it is ever regarded as a weapon at all. One sees it in the stocking tops of sober Scotsmen when they are in the glory of national dress, and it is just another piece of masculine costume jewellery. Mine was more functional. It had been given to me by my grandfather, who had it off his grandfather, so that made it at least 150 years old. Like any good piece of killing equipment, it had no unnecessary trimmings. Even the apparent decorations had a function. The ebony haft was ribbed on one side in the classic Celtic basket weave pattern to give a good grip when drawing, but smooth on the other side so it would draw clear without catching. The blade was less than 4 inches long, but long enough to reach a vital organ. Even the gaudy cairn gormstone set in the pommel had its use. It balanced the knife so that it made a superlative throw-in weapon. It lived in a flat sheath in my left stocking top. Where else would you expect to keep a Skian Dhu? The obvious way is often the best, because most people don't see the obvious. The customs officer didn't even look, not into my luggage and certainly not into the more intimate realms of my person.
Running Blind by Desmond Bagley is available from R&IB Talking Books, as narrated by Paul Tyerman. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Yeah, I'm just not that long ago, in the last few weeks, I've read a book by an author called Tony Kent. Tony is, he's actually a friend of mine as well, but he's also a very successful writer. He's a practicing criminal barrister, and he's written a book called The Shadow Myth. It is a seedy pants action thriller that starts off with an atrocity in The Hague. It then goes into the hero piece, a guy called Joe Dempsey, seeking to track down the people responsible for this. It's a really great international conspiracy theory. Tony writes brilliantly, with enormous pace and with great intrigue. And I really recommend everybody reads these. Absolutely.
Con's gaze had drifted back upwards and away from the screen, his paranoia once again taking hold as he questioned why he had agreed to any of this. But before his thoughts could spiral into anxiety again, his focus was dragged back to the moment. What he had been waiting for had finally arrived. Prochnik was smaller in the flesh than Con had anticipated. 5'5" at best. But that was not what stood out the most. Even in the searing heat, he was wearing a blue three-piece suit, so well tailored that it screened both wealth and undernourishment. There was no way the frame beneath the bespoke cotton and wool blend was more than 8 stone dripping wet. The build of a man who was busy working when he should have been eating. Duffy, in contrast, was a little over 6 feet tall and built like a fighter. Dressed in khaki cargo shorts and an aged white T-shirt that carried a faded picture of a famous boxer, he was in better shape than a man in his 50s had any right to be. And he looked even less like a lawyer than he did in his photo. More like the other guy's minder than his partner, Con thought. Their sudden arrival provided a moment of welcome respite, a break from the constant dread Con had been experiencing for days. In that instant of recognition, he had thought about something other than the danger he was in, something more than the risk he was taking. For that moment alone, Con was unburdened. An instant later, and the fear was back.
The Shadow Network by Tony Kent is available commercially, as narrated by Simon Slater. And once again, Neil Lancaster, thank you so much.
Been my absolute pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, you can always find another episode of Read On as a podcast. Well, over 350 episodes on your favourite podcast app. Just search for R&IB Read on Spotify, Google, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can email the show using radio@rnib.org.uk or find me on Twitter @talking_books.
Books and accessible reading on R&IB Connect Radio.